Nearly every day, there seems to be a new development about detainees in the war on terror. Yesterday, an appeals court ruled that the government can hold someone arrested in the United States as an illegal enemy combatant, but that the government must present some reasonable evidence to do so.
Also yesterday, at a hearing in Guantanamo, Osama bin Laden's former driver, Salim Hamdan, described his confinement there. Isolation, he said, sleep deprivation, sexual humiliations. He's scheduled to go on trial next week, but there probably will be more delays.
The first hint that the Bush administration had a new approach in its war on terror came 5 days after September 11, 2001, when Vice President Dick Cheney appeared on Tim Russert's Meet the Press.
We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows and in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful.
New Yorker journalist Jane Mayer writes about the dark side in a book that is published this week. It's called, appropriately, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Jane Mayer, welcome to Day to Day.
Thanks very much.
Well, you know, as a nation, the first inkling that the public had about this so-called dark side was Abu Ghraib and those photos, those shocking photos of the prisoners there. And, you know, at the time, the White House expressed outrage. Everyone said this was just horrible and that it was the work of just a few bad apples at the bottom of the chain of command. But you researched it, and you've researched this for years. You found that, in fact, no, this wasn't the work of a few bad apples. Where did these ideas of how to treat prisoners come from?
There was a complete program for this, and there was a curriculum, almost like a rule book on how to do it. It was in the Soviet Union during the days of Stalin's show trials and in Communist China and in Korea. And what happened was, during the Cold War years, the United States studied these techniques because they wanted to know how were the enemies getting false confessions out of Americans when they were taken captive. And so they did a lot of experiments, and they came up with basically a program for how to get people to do false confessions, which they copied from the communists. This program continue to exist even after the Cold War. It was a secret program in the military that's used to train U.S. forces on how to survive if they're ever taken captive by some kind of unscrupulous enemy. What happened after 9/11 is really just an incredible story, I thought. I stumbled across this almost by accident. The people that ran this tiny exotic program were tapped to tell U.S. officials how to actually interrogate our own captives. And what they wound up doing was emulating these hideous kinds of techniques of torture that were used by the communists during the Cold War.
So who decided to dust off this decades-old program and to use it not only at Abu Ghraib, but in places all over the world, in prisons in Afghanistan and in Guantanamo?
We still don't know everything about how this happened, but there are beginning to be more documents because Congress is now taking a slightly more aggressive stance in trying to explain what happened here. And what is clear is that the CIA, which was empowered after 9/11 to interrogate prisoners and really had no experience in doing so, sought help, and they sought help from the wrong people. They turned to these professionals in the military. Many of them were psychologists, interestingly enough, kind of Dr. Strangelove psychologists. And the CIA asked them for their advice in devising a program that would break down people in an interrogation. The irony of this was that these were techniques that had been used by communists to get false confessions out of people, not to get the truth out of people. And so, not surprisingly, subsequently, during the past 7 years, what we've seen is an awful lot of the information that the interrogation program has gotten out of terror suspects has turned out to be false. And it's sent America on all kinds of wild goose chases.
Well, one of the examples that the White House continually holds up to this day, holds up, is a man named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is widely believed to have been the architect behind the 9/11 attacks. And a lot of these techniques were used on him. And the administration has said to good effect that he's given loads and loads of great information, maybe information that's prevented terrorist attacks. What did you find?
Well, you know, of course, it's very hard for a reporter or for any American, actually, to evaluate these kinds of claims because nobody has access to the complete interrogation record or anything even approaching it. But I interviewed a lot of people at the CIA, both people involved in that case and other similar cases, and they cast a lot of doubt on the big claims that have been made, particularly in the case of KSM, as he's called. In particular, a top agent at the CIA had asked for some information from the KSM case to be able to give to allies in order to show that we were getting great stuff. He was told, actually, there isn't anything we can share because most of it's been recanted. It hasn't held up.
So we don't know if any of the information that was gleaned from his interrogation proved valuable or useful at all.
I tend to think that it's more gray than black and white. I'm sure that he gave some information that was good and some information that was bad. I mean, the challenge for the intelligence community when you start using coercion or brutalization or, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques, call it whatever you want, when you start hurting people, both psychologically and physically, people will talk, but they won't necessarily tell the truth. And it's very hard for even the best intelligence agents to sort of decipher what's true and what's not true.
You give an example of a man named, and I'll try to pronounce this correctly, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi.
Very good.
Thank you. He was accused of running one of bin Laden's terrorist training camps, training hundreds of jihadis, you know, being up there in the bin Laden hierarchy. He was captured and then says something while he's being interrogated about Iraq and actually provides a false link between al-Qaeda and Iraq.
When we think of the tragic consequences of the poor information that came out of this program, his case is really a prime example. First, he was talking quite openly to the FBI when they first captured him, and it didn't take any kind of coercion. But the CIA then took custody of him. He was then shipped to Egypt, where they apparently really put him through a terrible kind of torturous program. And it was at that point that he said later, he admitted, he made up stuff, telling people what he thought they wanted to hear. This was right before the war in Iraq, and al-Libi told them that Saddam Hussein was working with al-Qaeda and that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, all the things that we heard that helped create the drumbeat for the war. And the information that he provided then went directly into Colin Powell's speech at the UN, the monumental speech that really probably changed the public opinion on whether to go to war more than any other. It also made it into President Bush's speeches. And a year later, he admitted he'd made it all up and asked why. He said, I had to tell them something. They were killing me. So these are really the kind of collateral damage that only belatedly are we beginning to feel and be able to see from the quick fix of using torture right after 9/11.
Jane Mayer of The New Yorker magazine. Our conversation continues tomorrow about her new book. It's called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. So far, the White House has not responded to Jane Mayer's book, and we asked again today, and again, the White House did not respond.
Some of the literary tradition of New Orleans seems to have survived Hurricane Katrina. That's the impression you get when you hear from the author Julie Smith. She's written more than a dozen murder mysteries set in the city, and they give you a look at the secrets of a city where nothing is ever quite what it seems. NPR's J.J. Sutherland reports.
There's a door. A shirtless drunk is passed out in front of it. Then a bar. Then another door. It doesn't look promising. The stairwell is even less promising. Dark. Decrepit. Then, on the third floor, a door opens into a space seemingly the size of a bowling alley. An assault of color leaps off the walls, oranges and blues and greens. Pillars are painted in fantastic designs. The chandeliers are draped, no, covered, with gold Mardi Gras beads. The far wall, could be 100 feet away, is lined with books. Mysteries, mostly. Many of them written by the woman whose home this is, Julie Smith.
They say that New Orleans must be a great place to write mysteries, because there's so much crime there. And I always sort of have to laugh and say, oh yeah, that's just great. But of course, that has nothing to do with it. It's all about the secrets.
Julie Smith's New Orleans is full of secrets. The most famous detective she's invented, Skip Langdon of New Orleans Police Homicide, makes a living out of exposing those secrets. Skip is a tall, large woman who feels slightly out of place in her own body in her home of New Orleans. Smith says she represents her adolescent self, although they both obviously love the city they live in spite of its flaws. Here she is reading from her novel, House of Blues.
Yet despite crime and corruption, New Orleans remains arguably the most beautiful American city, the most gracious, the most charming. It is also the most eccentric. Walker Percy, one of its most revered writers, noted that here, the tourist is apt to see more nuns and naked women than he ever saw before, the combination being the intriguing part.
Smith says that everyone is welcome in New Orleans as long as they're not boring. On a hot, sticky day in July, Smith sits her hat on her head and ventures out into the city she loves and the secrets it hides, and how those secrets are inevitably revealed in a place where everyone seems to know everyone.
It is a city and a village at the same time. It's like there are only half a dozen people living here. Nobody has any secrets from anybody. Although they do. It's just that eventually everybody finds them out.
The drive uptown isn't long, but it is a world away. Graceful mansions, looking as if they're showing off to each other, line the streets of the Garden District. It was here that the Americans who came to the city hundreds of years ago built to impress the French locals. Didn't work, but their vanity has left a beautiful stain on the land. Smith walks up to one house which is in every guidebook. It is a sonnet written in balconies and iron lace. Surrounding its gardens is a fence made to look like cornstalks, leaves wrapping their way up, the finials bunches of metal-ripe corn that look almost good enough to eat. Julie Smith studies the mansion, which in one of her novels housed a large southern Gothic family, a corrupt judge, and of course, a murder.
Look how huge it is. Is that beautiful? But you can imagine lots of old family secrets occurring there, can't you? All kinds of stuff.
Only a short ferry ride away is a place very few tourists ever go, Algiers Point. It's a quiet neighborhood, says Smith. Affordable houses, not much crime, a good place to raise a family. But that's not quite what she has in mind as she leads the way to the top of the levee that hulks high between the houses and the Mississippi River.
I think it's just a divine place to dump a body if you should need to. I hope you never need to. What do you think? Would that be a good place?
She walks down the side of the levee to the woods, a verdant green of vines and plants.
How about if you went on the other side of those weeds? How perfect could that be? You probably should not hang out with too many crime writers. It'll really warp your sense of perspective.
Back on the other side of the river, the sun begins to set, and Julie Smith walks back through her favorite part of the city, which she never tires of, the French Quarter.
Sometimes you walk in the quarter, if you lived here as long as I am, and you look around and you think, am I really living here? Do I really get to look at this all the time? A beautiful and a really funky, broken-down kind of way. Better yet, I mean, the really best part is it's really quirky.
At the corner of St. Philip and Bourbon is her character Skip Langdon's favorite bar. Her favorite because it steps from her house and it has a hot bartender. It's called Jean Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop, supposedly the oldest bar in New Orleans. It's dark, and perhaps a fitting place to talk about the most horrific secret of New Orleans. It came to light almost 3 years ago during Hurricane Katrina, that the billions of dollars spent building levees to protect the city were for naught. Julie Smith's last novel was published just a week before the storm hit the city. The night before the waters came, she had a reading at a local bookstore. She hasn't published a book since.
I've had people say to me, I always read mysteries before I go to a city because that's how I learn what's really going on there. And I feel like that's my job, is to tell what's really going on here. And until I figure out what's really going on here, I'm not sure how to write. So it has changed and is changing me, and for a while really immobilized me.
It's an epical change, she says. The city has been irrevocably shaped by a devastation on a scale that is still almost impossible to grasp 3 years later. She speaks of the thousands of houses and hundreds of lives ended, of an almost impossible road back for a city that feels abandoned and betrayed by its own government. With all that, she asks, who would want to read a book about the death of just one person, which is what a murder mystery is? When asked how Skip would have handled the storm, Smith says she would have stayed. She would have been heroic. But then she pauses.
If I really think about it, I feel she would have gone into a depression afterward. She would have seen things that were really hard to handle, and she would have become very depressed for a period of time, but she would have got past that. She would have handled it.
Julie Smith says she's handling it too. She's writing again. It took her a while, but she hopes that someday she'll begin to understand her changed city enough to have Skip Langdon once again begin uncovering its secrets. J.J. Sutherland, NPR News, New Orleans.
This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, Sir Salman Rushdie reads from his new novel, The Enchantress of Florence.
He was both things, swordsman and shootist, male and female, himself in his shadow as well. She abandoned Shah Ismail as he had abandoned her and chose again. This pale-faced woman-man. Afterwards, he would claim her and her mirror as spoils of war, and Salim the Grim would agree. But she had chosen him long before, and it was her will that moved everything that followed. "Don't be afraid," he said in Persian. "Nobody in this place knows the meaning of fear," she replied. And beneath those words, the real words, "Will you be mine?" "Yes, I am yours."
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please visit npr.org/booktour.
Elin Harris has done it again. After 9 best-selling novels about the lives and loves of Black Americans, he is back. He's known for novels depicting main characters who struggle to understand their own sexuality, including some characters living on the down low. But his new novel, Just Too Good to Be True, focuses on a straight college football player struggling with his celibacy and the hard-knock game of college football recruiting. Elin Harris joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Pariah. How you doing?
I'm doing great. So it's out in stores today. Give us a scene setter for the emotional action.
Well, it's a story, like you said in your introduction, that takes place on the college football, on a college football campus. The main character, Brady Bledsoe, is a star in his own right, and he's kind of dealing with some issues when it comes to celibacy, a promise that he made to his mother, Carmen. You know, it's a book about college football. It's a book about mothers and sons, and it's a book about what happens when secrets are kept and when a young lady enters this young man's life.
You've got so many different aspects to it, but you certainly make out the game of football recruiting to be incredibly tough, and there's a lot of journalistic documentation of that. But how did you get into that world? How did you get a peek into the world of football recruiting in order to learn enough to write this book?
Well, Farai, you know, since 2003, I returned to my alma mater, the University of Arkansas, as a writer in residence and visiting professor. And what was really interesting is the first day of class, and I had never taught. I hadn't really looked over my roster, and I went into my classroom the first day, and there were a lot of student athletes in my class, young men who I had admired because I'm a big college football fan, I'm a big Razorback fan, and here were these students, you know, these guys in my class, and I wanted to go over and sit and talk to them about football, but I was, you know, the professor, if you will. And over the next 7 semesters as I taught, I became involved with the cheerleading. I was the first African-American cheerleader at the U of A and just got to know a lot of the students. And the idea for the book came from seeing them in the classroom with their bravado when they were around the young ladies, if you will, and then seeing them on Saturday afternoons with their mothers. They seemed like different people. And so it was just very, very easy because the interesting thing was they looked at me as maybe a contemporary, and they used to always want to talk to me. "What's up, Professor E?" If they would see me in the union, it wouldn't be uncommon for them just to plop down. So that's where the idea for the book came, and that's where the research started.
Now, let's talk in your book. You bring back Basil Henderson, who's one of your infamous, delightful characters. How much fun is it to kind of have this repertoire of people that you've created over the years that you can call on when you need them?
Oh, Farrah, it's the most fun in the world, because right now, you know, after I get off a tour, I go back to working on my 2009 novel, and I bring back some characters that were in my fifth novel. Basil is the only character that's been in every single novel, and I never know when he's going to show up. And we were talking about college recruiting. We were talking about agents. And everybody who's read any of my books knows that Basil is a football agent. So it only made sense that Brady, when considering the best agents in the country, would have to end up talking to Basil Henderson at some point.
There's so much in this book about mothers and sons, mm-hmm. and mothers and daughters as well. What did you want to say or explore about the relationships between mothers and their children?
Well, I have a very, very close relationship with my mom, and always have. That's not to say that we haven't had our difficulties, especially when I was at that age that Brady was, when you suddenly think you're turning into a man. But it is the most important relationship that I think a young man or a young woman will have in their lifetime. And I wanted to explore how you let go, if you will. You know, when do you let go? And when do you say, I've done the best that I can. You know, I'm going to have to trust that what I've taught my son or my daughter will be good enough to keep them in good stead in the world. Because Carmen is really worried about somebody getting a hold of Brady. You know, somebody who's going to influence him the wrong way, which is when Barrett enters. Carmen knows immediately, like some kind of, I hate to say it this way, but like an animal would know that their cub was in harm or what have you. She knows immediately that this young lady means her son no good.
What do you do to write? Writers do all sorts of things. Some people write early in the morning, some write late at night, some write, you know, 50 pages and put them down for 2 months. How do you write?
Well, it's really funny because I was talking about it to some students. I write at 5 o'clock. I turn my computer on at 5 o'clock. I turn my TV on. I'm not watching it, but I turn my TV on the A&E channel, Cold Cases and American Justice. I don't know. I'm listening, but I'm not really listening because I'm in tune with my characters. I have small yellow legal pads right by my computer, which I've jotted out a few notes of dialogue, of things I want to accomplish with what I'm going to write that day. And I write to about 7:30 or 7:45, because I won't reward myself with a glass of Chardonnay until I've done at least 1,500 words. And some days when I get around 3,000 or 4,000, I know I'm cooking and I know that it's good stuff.
On that note, many good pages to come. Elin Harris, thank you.
Thank you, Farrah.
That was bestselling author Elin Harris. His new book, Just Too Good to Be True, hits bookstores today.
In the books of the thriller writer Chelsea Kane, the city of Portland, Oregon, is a character, and that character is a woman.
A hot woman. In hiking boots.
A woman with complicated relationships.
She's probably got a little bit of a complex involving her older sister, her big sister, San Francisco, and her middle sister, Seattle.
And as imagined by the author, Portland is one haunted babe. In our continuing series, Crime in the City, NPR senior correspondent Ketzel Levine tours the dark town with the darker still, Chelsea Kane.
This much I know. She likes being noticed, even on this empty beach along the Columbia River. The silk scarf loose around her neck trails her like Dior. Poison. Her dark glasses and vamp lipstick are startling as the wind whips her unnaturally honeyed hair.
I started walking here with my mom, and I actually came to Portland when my mom was dying of cancer. That's how I moved to Portland. So right away I had this sort of mixed relationship with the city.
Chelsea Kane may fly her sentences like kites, but she is no dippy dame.
I often, when I am walking in the wilderness, keep my eye open for bodies. I do. Ever since I was a kid. You know, I think I read too many Nancy Drew books to start, and it went from there. You know, you never know when you might come across a dead body. And the converse of that is to think, well, where is a good place to dump a dead body?
She points to a mound of sand. I know where this is heading. Heartsick. I've read the book.
She'd been strangled and then soaked in bleach like the others. She lay 5 feet from the water's edge, on her back, head to the side. One leg was slightly bent, the other straight, tangled in river weed.
An unholy mess on a stretch of sand and sunshine. Why is Chelsea Kane dreamt a corpse into being here on Portland's pastoral Sauvie Island, 10 miles west in a twilight zone from urban woe? Then it hits me like a pail of you-picked berries. Beauty kills.
People come to Portland, many of them, for the quality of life. And yet, you know, every year, people climbing the mountain get killed by avalanches. And I think that there's just a really interesting tension in the fact that there's this incredibly beautiful environment all around us that picks people off one by one.
Frankly, it's a relief to be back in the city. Truth is, it's a little unnerving being alone with Chelsea Kane. Her dark side is as startling as silence on the radio. You see what I mean. The leafy boulevards of downtown Portland are not among Chelsea Kane's crime scenes yet. So far, she's only published the one thriller, Heartsick. But I've a bad feeling. That's why we're about to sneak in where we're not supposed to be.
I feel like somebody's going to come around the corner and bust us.
Just act naturally, you guys.
We're in a club, members only. Gail Hayes Davis got us in. A woman with the looks of a trophy wife and the brains of a school principal.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Turns out, she was one. We're here because this place, the Arlington Club, will figure in Chelsea Kane's sequel, a book no one has yet seen.
The detective at one point and the journalist come and stay here. There's a serial killer on the loose, and they're in danger. So they put them in the Arlington for safekeeping.
Yes, you can't get in without being noticed.
It's like the Berlin Wall. They shoot you if you come across.
No.
Thinking to walk out before getting thrown out, I make our excuses. Next stop, Portland's densely wooded refuge, its name, Forest Park.
Careful. Come on, let's get a pass.
This is where we're meeting a friend of Chelsea Kane's, writer Susie Vitelli, who holds in her hand a cheap, shiny paperback. It isn't. It is. It's Sweetheart, the sequel, and it's due out this fall.
Forest Park was pretty in the summer. Portland's ash sky was barely visible behind a canopy of aspens, hemlocks, cedars, and maples that filtered with the light to a shimmering pale green. The creek hummed and churned. Birds chirped. It was all very lovely, very Walden, except for the corpse.
Something's not quite right about this Susie Vitelli. This much I know. She's no innocent. The woman's too quick to agree that this model train set of a city could contain such evil.
The books that are set in Portland aren't generally in this genre. And so this is sort of breaking new ground. And I think it's helping to broaden people's idea of what's here.
None for the good, that's my take. I see the city's jewel, Forest Park. She and her writing buddy see a graveyard.
I'm sure there are bodies just waiting to be dug up.
Are you serious?
I'm sure.
Bodies in Forest Park? It's 5,000 acres. There are at least 5 bodies in this park right now.
I would agree.
Oh, please, bodies. Yet Chelsea Kane won't relent. She dares me to come back with her alone. Tonight, she will hold the flashlight.
Chelsea, put the light on.
Sorry.
We have been here before, but now it's pitch black and we're heading into Forest Park.
Are you scared? I'm a little uncomfortable. Hear that creak?
And the air is exquisite. It's not very ominous. So why thrillers?
It was a story, you know? I mean, I love scary stories.
See if we can get up here?
Okay. You lead the way.
Oh, look at this. Somebody was buried alive here. And this
Stop
is the
it.
Pipe we're allowed to breathe through. It's okay.
You know how I talked about the bodies in Forest Park? I think we're the bodies that we're looking for. Okay. I'm going to go down and then I'm going to shine the flashlight up. So I'm going to leave you for just a moment, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
You know, an imagination like this woman's, and you start walking in the park at night with a flashlight, you can understand what she comes up with, even in a beautiful, idyllic place like Portland.
I'll catch you. Whoa! 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 Whoa!
Ketzel? Ketzel Levine? Looks like another reporter vanished into our Crime in the City series. You can find out what happened to Ketzel Levine at NPR.org.
Today we're going to hear about a new legal thriller from lawyer-turned-writer Paul Goldstein. His novel is called A Patent Lie. Here's our reviewer, Alan Chews.
This new novel by New York transplant-turned-Californian Paul Goldstein trumps John Grisham's work in every way: character, setting, plot, the prose, and it gives the interested reader, that is, someone with a pull toward the drama of a high-value legal case heading into trial, a great reward for his or her attention. The protagonist is an intellectual property lawyer named Michael Seeley, a reformed alcoholic and former high-powered New York City corporate attorney who's retreated to his native Buffalo. His only sibling, a doctor, medical advisor to a Northern California biotech firm, shows up at his office to hire him as main counsel for a federal patent law case. The former lead counsel has somewhat inconveniently committed suicide. Seeley puts his solitude and his doubts about the case behind him and flies west. The case is timely and fascinating, all about patent infringement on the American company's AIDS vaccine by a huge European conglomerate. Seeley's preparation for the trial and the trial itself form the heart of the narrative. Goldstein narrates all this so skillfully, from jury selection to final judgment, that even a novice at the law such as myself can understand it without the author having to sacrifice any of the complex chemistry of the case. But this is more than just a story about procedure. Attorney Seeley is hardly cold-blooded, and if he fights back his thirst for alcohol, he does allow his sympathy to go to work when the late former counsel's widow asks him to prove that her husband, the suicide, was actually murdered. Seeley also succumbs to the attractions of a somewhat reluctant potential witness, a beautiful Chinese scientist whose work on the AIDS vaccine eventually takes center stage in the development of the plot. And when it comes to following his passion for the revelation of the seemingly simple case's intricate truths, there's no stopping Seeley. There's no stopping the reader, either. I read the book in nearly one sitting on a recent cross-country flight. I wish the flight had been longer.
Paul Goldstein's new novel is called A Patent Lie, and it's the answer to the question, what would our reviewer, Alan Chews, read?
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.